Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Set Lessing Bruce, your podcast all about Bruce Springsteen, his music, and mostly his fans. I am your host, Jesse Jackson. Joining me is a longtime first-time guest, Dave Barry, who has been on the podcast multiple times talking about his wonderful Kickstarter, is joining me today. And we will talk about the Kickstarter, but mostly we're talking about his Springsteen journey. So, Dave, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Excited to be here tonight because I actually get to be a fan for a little bit, which I'm looking forward to.
That sounds great. Yeah. So let's get this out of the way first. So for those of you who may not know, David has successfully launched and funded a Kickstarter. And it is all about Bruce Springsteen's journey with his fandom. And hopefully everyone listening to this had been a part of it. But even if you were not part of the Kickstarter, we're going to tell you at the end how to get involved with the film even now. But before we get to the regular episode, why don't you give us an update on how things are going, Dave?
It's going great. I am in pre-production and getting ready to order up the first batch of reward swag things that we did. We did a few Kickstarter challenges, and each time the community stepped forward and did not disappoint and met each challenge. And so we're going to be giving, keychains, buttons, and bandanas to every single person that backed the film as well, Tramps Like Us swag. Who doesn't like a little bit of swag, right? So that's getting ordered. And I'm deep into pre-production, starting to schedule where I'm going to be interviewing people and who's being interviewed. We've had tremendous response to the form I put up to be interviewed, and it's great to read everybody's stories. And I'm really getting into the swing of actually making this thing happen now. So busy.
Yeah, and one of the nice things is you had hit a stretch goal. That's why we're all getting extra stuff, because there's always a few people that, because of circumstances changed, aren't able to make their pledges. And we know that's there. We still love you. We appreciate you. But I think it's great that we got a little lagniap, as we say in Louisiana, and we're on our way making a film.
We are.
Yeah, we will be doing on a regular basis. We have to figure out what is regular, but when there is something to update and to keep us on the journey, Dave and I will be doing kind of a podcast feed for just the Kickstarters, the people that back the thing. So those will be coming up in the meantime. Keep an eye out on your Kickstarter email. You'll get something from us. But if someone's interested in following the process, where do they go?
TrampsLikeUsFilm.com, and then Tramps Like Us on Facebook, at Boss Fan Film on Twitter. And I think that's the same one on Instagram too. I'm updating everywhere. And of course, even on the Kickstarter campaign itself, I do updates as to what's going on. We won't be hard to find, that's for sure.
That is awesome.
And then I'll post everything in the big groups as well. Spring Nuts and Calling All Springsteen Fans, E Street, everybody that'll let me, basically.
That sounds perfect. All right. So we're going to take off your filmmaker hat and you're going to put on your fandom hat. I always like to start beginning, Dave. Where did you grow up and what kind of music did your family listen to when you were growing up?
I was born and raised in New Jersey. I am a New Jersey guy. I lived in New Jersey
Nice.
until I was 21 years old. That's when I moved away from New Jersey. I come from the traditional New Jersey Irish Catholic kind of background. The kind of music that I grew up listening to or that was in our house, let's see. My dad was a Buddy Holly fan.
Nice.
Always liked Buddy Holly more than Elvis. I always asked him why. He said that Buddy Holly just seemed cooler to him, which I always thought was interesting.
I love that.
And my mom liked the Beatles. She was 13 years younger than my dad, so she liked the Beatles. And I remember in the 70s, my mom was a big John Denver fan. I remember them actually going into New York City to see John Denver once. And so there was a good mixture of different kinds of music that we heard in the house. Yeah.
So I love John Denver when I was, because I graduated high school in 77. So he was one of the people we heard on the radio all the time. I was lucky enough to see him perform live twice there in Lake Charles. It was the first concert in the round
Wow.
where his, where he was standing was in a circle. And the band was all around him, and the center thing where he
Yeah.
was moved slowly. So
Oh.
he looked at the whole audience. We did that. This is before you had the big screens. So think my, he is not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nor in the Country Music Hall of Fame. And I think that's just, in fact, I was a little sad. I watched the making of We Are the World documentary that's on Netflix, really well done, at least from a fan perspective. I thought it was good. And but there is a line where someone says, if we have a bomb, John Denver's back on top. And I
Yep,
thought
I remember that.
that was a little sad because he, there was a time when he was just everywhere doing everything.
He
He
was.
was movie star, TV shows, live concerts, and some of his music is just classic. So I get.
Funny about him too is that I actually met him a couple times when I was a kid because
Oh, really?
he was very into aviation, and my father was the president of his EAA chapter, which is the Experimental Aviation Association. So I grew up around small planes and stuff. And we used to go out to Oshkosh, Wisconsin every summer for the big air show for their big EAA thing. And he was a part of that. And I ran into him once in a museum there, and he actually stopped and talked to me. Like, I was just a kid, but I think he was
Yeah.
infatuated that there was a kid in there. And then he went through our campground once on a little golf cart going driving through. My mom saw him, was all like, she got to go out and say hi to him too. And he was very gracious and very kind, very nice. But it's funny the things that you remember. I actually met him twice when I was a kid over a couple of years, which was interesting.
That is interesting. Yeah. So as you're growing up, what kind of music, when you started finding your own voice, what kind of music were you listening to?
I was very influenced by what was in the house. I should also say that it's around 78 was when I first started to hear Bruce, because my older brother was a Bruce Springsteen fan and we shared a bedroom. I wasn't really a music fan yet, but I started to hear it. Like, I knew that my mom w liked music and I knew that my dad liked music. So I was starting to just learn the place of it in your life.
Yeah.
When I was very young, I actually remember going through a little bit of a Kiss phase, but I think that was more about the makeup and being able to dress up like them for Halloween. And then the first real big musical thing that I was a fan of was actually Bruce, and that was in 1980. I was aware of a lot of different kinds of music, but it wasn't until I was, what was that 1980? I was 11. It wasn't until I was 11 that music that I really made the connection with it, and it happened to be Bruce. I guess I'm a real loyal guy like that because that's been what I've been with. I mean, in college, I listened to some other things. I guess the palette grew, right? But
Yeah.
the core stuff stayed there with me, which was Bruce and then U2 just after that. Those were the two things. But even from that age all the way through, that's pretty much like 90% of my listening has always been, since that age, has always been Bruce and U2, which I know probably sounds boring to people, but I like what I
No.
like, you know?
Yeah. Did
Yeah,
did can you talked about your brother knowing Bruce. You talked about it. Can you remember when it became more than just something you're another band you're listening to? Is there a specific Road to Damascus moment? And if
Yes.
so, can you articulate why it spoke to you?
Absolutely. I remember it crystal clear, actually. Growing up in New Jersey, you're always aware of him, right? I was born in and lived up in northern Jersey until I was 14, 15 years old. My father worked for the phone company, and he
Okay.
got transferred down to Freehold, New Jersey. And so
Okay.
when I was 14, 15 years old, I was a sophomore in high school. We moved from my friends and from everybody I knew down to Central Jersey, Freehold. So I was aware that I was very close to the Mecca, right?
Yeah.
I didn't know it as the Mecca then, but I knew he was from Freehold. But it took a while to make friends and everything there. And during the winter time in New Jersey, it gets dark early. So you'd get home from school and it would be 4 o'clock and it's starting to get dark out already. And I remember laying on my bed in my bedroom, listening to Factory, listening to Independence Day, and waiting for my dad to get home. And I was forming those thoughts about my relationship with my dad and his relationship with his work, because it impacted me when I was 14 when we moved, right? It upended my world, and not in a bad way, but it did. It changed my life. I was no longer in my group of friends in northern New Jersey that I had always known, and so for the first and I made plenty of friends in Central Jersey, but for the first 6 months or so, you just don't know a lot of people yet. It's a new school, it's a new everything. And those songs were things that I listened to literally every single day after school. Every day, I'd come home and I'd put on The River and I'd listen to these songs. And I also, that's when I started to discover the rest. I was aware of the rest of it because of my brother, but I didn't have a job or anything, so I didn't own a lot of albums. My brother's 7 years older than me, so he didn't move with us. He was already out on his own, so that influence was taken away. I didn't have a job yet, so I couldn't buy a lot of albums. It took me a while, right? I had The River and I had a few others, and that's what I listened to. I listened to them on cassettes in my room just over and over and over. And that was the beginning of it, really. But I remember very distinctly thinking about the relationship between sons and fathers because it was so prevalent in those songs. My father and I had a good relationship, but I'd say it improved as I got older and you start to realize and you learn just how hard of a job that actually is. But when you're a kid, I was the typical rebellious teenager, probably with a chip on my shoulder because we just moved away from this area that was home to me, my friends, and all that. So those songs were, even at 15 years old, they had a lot of weight to me.
What I find interesting is I did not have that connection till the River reunion tour a few years ago when he did the River in its entirety. And he was in the Independence Day introduction. He talked about this father and son both loving each other but not knowing how to say it. And it struck me that Bruce was now older than his father probably was when he wrote that song. And so now he's seeing it from his father's perspective.
Very
And
true.
that struck me as something really significant. The other thing that made my lovely bride unhappy is she and Chris, who's my son, had that kind of relationship. They adored each other, but they just fought. And they're good now, but and so I did get that, and now that has become one of my favorite songs, that whole idea of that. How do I tell this person that I admire and love that I do understand, but that I'm not going to let them do to me what they did to you? Almost sounds like criticism, but it's coming from a place of love. And the idea that I think a father wouldn't always, a parent, period, want something better for their children?
I think that's really deep at the core of it. But there's an element of rock and roll is the music of rebellion, and even in a mournful way, I find in Independence Day, that spirit kind of rings there. I'm not going to let them do to me what I watched them do to you. As a young man, you don't know what your father's going through. You only know what it looks like to you. And you have grandiose dreams and things that you want to go out into the world and pursue. And I think that that theme was permeating through a lot of Bruce's early work, right? Born to Run. He said it in Broadway, Mr. Born to Run. I was trying to get out. He ended up living just a few miles from where he was trying to run away from his whole life.
Yeah.
But that theme was there, and it had a profound influence on me, because when I was 21 years old, I moved 2,500 miles away from my family and went to school in Las Vegas at UNLV. And I was the first one in our family to move that far like that and do something like that. It had a profound influence on me. And my relationship was similar like that. My mother is technically my stepmother, although I've always seen her as my mom. She raised me from the time I was 3, but we definitely butted heads like that. Now, as a mature adult, we are very close, right? And those wounds healed and all of that. But when you're a kid, that can be tough. And so there was a definite, you know, I'm going to get away from this. You know, I'm not going to live that life that I see you guys stuck in. And those influences came from Darkness, Born to Run. There's a bit of it in Greetings, certainly The River. Those albums had a very profound impact on the teenage and 20-something year old person I was becoming, I'd say.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Why did you decide to go to school in Vegas? And what were you wanting to study?
I went to school originally for architecture. Funny enough, and I'll go through that. But what was I trying to escape? I was trying to get away from the Jackson Cage. I worked at Six Flags Great Adventure in high school in Jackson, New Jersey. As soon as I got my driver's license, I remember my best friend Chris and I driving up and down Route 9, blaring Born to Run, because we were going to get out of this place someday. And I did. Chris actually stayed there, still lives. He now lives in Trenton, New Jersey, but he stayed in the area. Trenton's not that far, actually, from it's still central Jersey. But I certainly did. I went all the way out west. And that's something I've always found interesting, particularly recently, because I knew that Bruce, he wrote about a lot of Western influence in those songs, right? But I didn't know he had that love affair with it until recently. He talked about it, you'd hear it in things, but he went into great detail in the Western films, Western Stars film, right? And you really got he was very vivid in a lot of his descriptions. And you know what? I felt the same exact way when I got out west. I couldn't believe how much sky you could see. I couldn't believe, you know, the colors that you would see in the mountains and all of these things, all those things he talked about experiencing when he first drove across the United States, right? I had that same experience when I left when I was 21 and drove to Las Vegas, which made me feel really good in my 40s when I saw that, my 50s when I saw that and learned that. I was aware of it. You'd read it in interviews or see little clips here or there, but the detail he went into in Western Stars about that experience, and also a bit on the Broadway show when he talked about driving cross country, right? And that just made me feel good. I guess that's what happens to Jersey guys when we get out at that age and go out west. It's such a different experience.
So Dave, now,
I'm sorry, I went to UNLV to go to school for architecture. Yeah. I had always loved drawing. I was 2 years away from a master's degree in architecture when I switched into communications. I burnt out on drawing. It wasn't fun anymore. But I had taken a broadcast television class, because when you're going to school for architecture, your course load is extremely heavy. You're doing 18 to 22 credits every semester easily. It's more than a full-time job. And so you look for that one class where you're not going to get a lot of homework, which was, you can't take a television station home with you. So there's your communication credit. But all that art design and things like that gave me a natural eye for it. Like I could just tell framing, and I enjoyed the creativity in it. By that time, I was also starting to write my own songs and play music in local bands and things like that. And so I was going more into the creative drawing and ended up getting a communications degree and working in television from the time I was 25. My path changed, but that's what took me to Las Vegas and UNLV, was to study architecture. So just finishing the other thing you asked me about.
No, interesting, because I went back for I think it was my 40th high school reunion. It was a few years ago, and I was struck by how many of my classmates never left Moss Bluff or Lake Charles, Louisiana. It's a very small little town. We weren't even an official suburb. Moss Bluff was not incorporated. It was just a community north of Lake Charles. And in a lot of ways, I was jealous, because some of them right out of high school got to work at a petrochemical plant, factory, worked, did their 30 years and got a pension, and they're retired, right? Yeah. And still living just a few miles from where their parents lived. And and I knew I didn't want to live there. I knew I wanted to. And so Lynn and I got married in 84, and in 86, we moved to Dallas. And we've been here ever since. And I admire them some ways that they're that happy and they're doing, but other ways you go, I don't understand that. I don't understand how you want to not have that. I got to get out of here.
Quite literally. I would agree. That's really, like I said, my best friend, Chris, he from high school, he stayed there, and we still talk. We talk a couple times a year. I'll see him when I'm filming in New Jersey this year. Right. But when we were in our late 20s, I think I even asked him about it a few times. Like, I didn't understand how he could just stay. Like, I just had this thing in me where I had to go.
Yeah, and exactly.
I don't know. So I guess some people up to the point where I think about it in a similar way now, Jesse. There's a part of me that wonders, like what's it like to be able to find that kind of peace early on where you're comfortable where you're living and that's just where you want to be, and to be able to make a life with those kind of roots. That wasn't the path that I took, but
And
it's
I think
interesting.
part of mine was my dad was in the army, so we moved around a lot as a kid. I always thought it was cool that people that were sophomores in high school would pick at each other, that in the third grade they had crushes on each other, right? They had known each other. And when my dad got out of the army, my parents divorced, I started my freshman year at Sam Houston, and that was the first school I'd spent 4 years in a row in. Every other I'd be changing
Wow.
every year or something. So that was something different for me.
Yeah.
So Dave, I know you ended up spending time in Hawaii.
Yes,
So
sir.
talk to me how, and I don't know if these are connected, but you talked about graduating, you talked about in TV. How does your journey becoming a filmmaker and going to Hawaii, is that connected at all, or are they two separate paths?
No, they're connected. I was living and working in Las Vegas in the area, and I lived and worked in Vegas for 13 years. I stayed out west after I finished school, and I met somebody who hired me to go out to Maui to do a corporate video for the Marriott group, right?
Okay.
And this guy had a business where they did destination management. So that was like they put on corporate events and things like that. And so I was there to do like the highlights video at the end of these meetings for the Marriott. And he was a really cool guy. His name was Dusty Rhodes. Interesting name. But he had a lot of friends on Maui. And so we had a really great shoot. And he had rented a condo that we worked out of. We weren't actually staying in the Marriott. We were just down this little walkway in these little vacation rentals. That's where I was working out of. And I was doing the editing, and I'd get up every day and I'd go out and I'd start editing. I still remember the time it was in April of, if I think, 96 or 97, right? But I was a kid from Jersey, and I'm getting up in the morning and I'm looking out the window as the sun's coming up in Hawaii at the bluest ocean I've ever seen. And there's whales breaching out the window because it was whale season. I'd never seen anything like this in my life. It was just beautiful. And the shoot went really good. And it was going to be time to go back to Las Vegas. And Dusty said, "Hey, you know what? I feel like staying a few extra days. If you don't have anything you need to do, I'll change your ticket and extend it. And you can stay in the condo and have a little bit of a break out here." And I was, "Sure." And so I got to see a little bit more of Maui, and I met some of what the local people were like. And then it planted a seed in my head where someday I want to live there. That's what I thought. And so I stayed in Vegas a while longer, and I was doing film and television work, and I was starting to travel around a bit for work, and had worked in North Carolina for a couple of years, but was still working with people in Vegas. And it got to the point where I was going to be traveling a lot, and it didn't really matter where I was going to call home. And so I decided to move to Maui because at least when I was home, I was going to be someplace where the water was always warm so I could surf because I used to surf a lot. I could go in the ocean all year. And I always tell people that you move to Hawaii because you fall in love with the physical beauty of the island. It is a beautiful place, but you stay in Hawaii if you're going to stay there for any period of time because you fall in love with the people and the culture. And that's exactly what happened to me. I met locals and they were just some of the warmest, most wonderful people you can imagine. And I got caught up with Uncle George Kahumoku Jr., who is a five-time Grammy Award-winning slack key artist. I was filming his shows and helping him. And I'd go up to his farm and he was teaching me Hawaiian culture and history while we were working on the farm. And then I'd leave every day with all the fruit and vegetables and things I could possibly eat. And when he was a famous Hawaiian musician and he knew my background in film and television. And so he had an album that was up for a Grammy Award again. It was called Vau Akua. It was an instrumental album. Vau Akua means Garden of the God, spiritual area up country in Hawaii, which means going up the mountain, where there was a forest that was only supposed to be for spiritual use. And he, every periodically, people would ask him, well, we should do a movie about you, because George was a, he was a famous musician, but he was a farmer, he was a teacher, he was a sculptor, he was an artist. He was, they call him Hawaii's Renaissance man. He was a very amazing person. Anyway, somebody came to him and said, hey, George, we want to make a movie about you. But all they ever wanted to talk to him about was his music, musical career. And that was about 5% of what George did, actually. It was a very small part of what was important to him. And he said, no, you know what? I think it's time we do something like this. But Dave, would you do it? Because I know you make films, you work in professional production, but you know the whole story. And I said, yeah. And we thought about how we were going to do it. And somebody turned us on to the idea of Kickstarter. And that was the first film that I actually kickstarted. We raised $30,000 to do it. And that launched me into making films about Hawaiian musicians, because that film was successful. We got into Hawaii International Film Festival. It was on PBS. But George, seeing what it was, he thought, you know what, this would be great to do for other Hawaiian musicians too. So let's, and I said, I would love to make more movies. And so we set out about doing two films a year based on just raising what we could, because by this time I had equipment, I had cameras, I had the ability to edit, and I had the experience and knowledge to do it. The film series that we did, we made 8 Hawaiian films, and that was born out of the idea of making the films for what we could raise, just so I could keep the lights on and get to where I need to go to shoot. But it was a calling, really, to tell the story behind these musicians, and because Hawaiian music is incredibly cultural and it carries the history of Hawaii. So I felt a large kuleana, which is a Hawaiian word for responsibility, right? Everybody tends to, one of the tenets of aloha is to just do what you can, right?
Okay.
And so that was what I could do, right? And so I set out to make these films with George, and I'm very proud of it. But that's what, so it is all interconnected, right? I went to Hawaii because I was there to work, and I fell in love with the place. And once I was traveling so much for work, it didn't matter where I was going to be, call home. And so I said, I'm going to go there. And after I got there, I set roots and found a wonderful community that I love dearly, and that we lived there for 15 years.
Why did you decide to move?
We left Hawaii because when I moved over there, I was a single man. I had known my wife for a long time, but we were just friends. Almost 11 years ago now, she came over to, she had been married and then she got divorced and she'd been single for a while. And we'd been friends through all of this stuff. And she came over to Hawaii to visit. And that's when things changed between us. And it was like, okay, either if this is going to work, you're going to have to come here, because I'm not going to move back to Las Vegas. And so yeah, she moved over to Hawaii and we decided to start a family. And we had our son right away, who is now almost 10. Abel is, his birthday's in April. But at first, Hawaii was my choice. And then it was Crystal's choice by proxy, right? And we built a life there. It was wonderful. Abel was born there, and that is a magical, amazing thing to be able to say. But we felt that as he was getting older, that we were limiting his experiences. It is a beautiful and wonderful place full of people that we love dearly. But he had never really met his grandparents. He had never, like, when you live there, it is so expensive that you can keep the roof over your head, but you can't do a whole lot else. We weren't able to open up the world to him, and we felt like it was just time to do that. Now, he may... We're both fascinated to see what he does, because he will always remember Hawaii. He left there when he was 9, right? Will he someday go back to it? I don't know. Does he miss it? I think he misses it a little bit, but I also think that he, like me, he looks at the desert, and right now he's fascinated by how beautiful the mountains are and the browns and how much bigger things seem. And we'll see how that works, but he has acclimated very well, and Crystal has, and so have I, but we had lived here before.
Yeah.
And I think we made the right choice.
What I think's interesting is when he gets older, where are you from? Will he say, Hawaii? Will he say California? Will he, what, where? That'll be interesting. We're going to get back to Bruce, but you've done a lot of films, a lot of it about a lot of Hawaiian music. And I want to know, first off, talk to me about Midnight Muse, the Las Vegas little film you did. And then I want to ask, why do you think your calling has ended up being music documentaries?
I can.
Okay, good.
Okay, so Midnight Muse, I was asked to do that by another producer friend in Las Vegas. It was on a real small micro budget. And they knew I could do things like that on small budgets. They also knew I had a real passion for music, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Yeah.
I love that little film. Midnight Muse is the story of the musicians behind the big stars of the heyday in Las Vegas, right? So what was interesting about that period of time, yes, it was when the mafia ran things here, but each one of the hotels had a huge orchestra, 30-piece orchestras. And Vegas was this really unique place where musicians could move and they could get a job with the music union and they could have real income, which would be hard to do anyplace else in the world. And they were coming here and they were building lives and buying houses, and they weren't getting like wealthy, but they had stability. They had a livelihood, and it was a thriving community of musicians here. The guys who played in the orchestras behind Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack and behind Elvis and all the musicians. And what happened is, as corporations moved into Vegas, they decided they wanted to, you know, increase the bottom line, and they ended up being able to force the orchestras out. But that's what that film is about. It's about the story of the rise of that period of time, interviewing a lot of old musicians who lived here and worked here, and then kind of what happened. And there's been a little bit of a revival. There's a few places where you can see full. But I love that film, and I'm so glad you brought it up. That one's been on PBS as well, and I just think it's a wonderful story. It's one of my favorite things I got a chance to work on, because music is my thing. Now, why do I tell musical stories? When I was 20 years old, actually probably even a little younger, I got the musical bug, and I wanted to play music, and I played music, and I wrote songs and pursued a career in music and got close. I almost signed a distribution deal twice. It didn't work out, right? It wasn't the way I was going to go. Now, I got into film because I, in the 90s, like a lot of people who are musicians, and as I was also a U2 fan, I went in 1991 to see the Zoo TV tour with all the screens and everything. And my brain got just so many people. It's hard to explain to people now because we're so used to seeing concerts with video screens behind you and things like that. But in 1991, when they did that, that was groundbreaking. It was, nobody had done anything like that. And so I saw that and I was like, I want that for my own music. And how do I do that? And I've always been the type of person that, you know, rather than say, oh, that's impossible, I'll just go and try and find a way to do it. So that's how I started taking, learning about doing things like that. And then I took that communications class, and then I was given access to a television studio. One thing went to another, and I ended up in film and television. But that love for music had been growing from the time I was a teenager, when I was first listening to Bruce and finding the power of Independence Day, like we talked about earlier, right? And exploring that and learning the idea of, I don't want to say running away, but getting out, right? Like how Bruce did, and U2 and Bruce Springsteen taught me to dream. And those were the driving forces in my life, and music was what I was drawn to. And so if I was going to do something different, telling stories about music is the thing that I'd be most passionate about, right? And it is. I love telling musical stories. If I have a niche, I'd say that's what it is, telling musical stories. So there's how that happened.
So I'm going to have to check out the Vegas one, because this reminds me, and it's not the similar thing, but like the Wrecking Crew, right? That there's that wonderful documentary about all these musicians in Los Angeles, these studio musicians that played on everyone's records,
right?
And the idea that back then and now I'm going to sound like an old fart. We didn't do recorded tapes. We did live music. You went to hear when you heard Sammy and Dean and Elvis or whatever, it was an orchestra, right? And it was an experience. And yes, I could see how I could make a few extra bucks if I just have a smaller band and we could fill in recorded music, but it's not the same. I'm going to have to check that out.
I'll send you a link to it for sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to get back to Bruce, but I'm curious, Dave, do you have itch to do something else besides, now I know you're busy with our Bruce film, but do you have an itch to do something that's not a documentary or a different kind of documentary? Would you want to produce or direct a film noir or a comedy or something?
Interesting that you would ask me that. I wrote my first narrative script a year ago.
Okay.
And it was it's based on real events that actually happened in the 1990s in Las Vegas with me and the band that I was forming and playing with and the guy I wrote all the songs that I wrote with. It's just based on that, though. There's a lot of reality of conversations we really had, things that we really did. But it's a work of fiction also because it has other things in it. But I wrote that just a year ago, and I would like to make that film. And that's not a documentary. That's an actual narrative film. Will I ever get to? I don't know. I'm told the script is very good, but it's a different kind of filmmaking. We'll just see. We'll see if that ever happens or not. But again, that's a musical story, right? And people read that script and they're like, oh my gosh, you can really write. You should write more. The thing is that I can only really work on the things that I'm passionate about, I've learned. So if you were to ask me to write an adventure film, I wouldn't be able to do it because it's not something that I've lived in and that I'm passionate about. But if you ask me to write about the kinds of music that I listen to or experience that I had that are around things that I'm passionate about, I can do that. The same thing with the documentaries. All the films I made are really the musics that I'm passionate about and that I love and that I've lived. I can make a great Bruce Springsteen movie or YouTube movie because that's been my life. I'm 55 years old. It's been my entire life. So I know it. But if you were to ask me to do that for another band, because other people have said they saw what I did with Dream Out Loud, I'm like, oh my gosh, you should do it for this band or that band. And it's, I don't think I could. Because I don't know their music the way I know.
So when you were doing your day gig, how hard was it to do these films to promote this corporate culture? You're doing this film. It was more like editing somebody else's podcast, right? I'm trying to put in blank, right? Like when I edit this podcast, I know I've had the discussion, I've talked to them, and this is something I love. Now, if someone else gives me this, I can work through it and I will do a good job, but it won't have the same sense of passion.
That's an interesting question. I think I've been doing this stuff for a really long time, Jesse. I know how to tell a story effectively, whether it's a story that I feel in the marrow of my bones or whether it's something I'm just being hired to do. I'm still very effective at it, right? It's like any other, I guess you want to believe that it's always just about the passion and the art. And to a certain degree, there is, but it almost becomes a practice in a way, right? Sometimes. And like any other job, there are parts that are just absolutely thrilling. And there are parts that are literally like watching paint dry. And that's just the nature of having a career with something. That's not different or not similar to what anybody else deals with in their jobs.
Yeah, sometimes I'm writing up a new process and I try to do a good job. I try to do a good presentation. I'm trying to sell a program or something. But it isn't with the same energy as if I'm doing a Springsteen podcast. Though I would love to see, I think you'd do a hell of a Penn and Teller documentary, right? So
I've met Penn and Teller.
Yes. Yeah.
I filmed them in Las Vegas before.
Yeah.
They were fun to be around, kind.
Yes.
And they did it very extremely professional and did their jobs. And it was a great shoot. I don't know. Could I maybe?
Yeah.
Penn's a big Springsteen fan, isn't he? Or
He's
is
a
it Stella?
huge Dylan
No, it's
fan.
Penn. It's
Yeah,
Penn.
Penn is a huge Dylan fan.
Oh, Dylan it
He
is. Okay.
likes Bruce, but Dylan is his passion.
Okay.
And
Yeah.
that's on my wish list of if I had, I would love Penn to be on here to talk Dylan, right?
Oh man, you'd
Yeah,
have to try and do that.
yeah,
Yeah.
that's yeah, that would be great. So let's get back to Bruce for a little bit. Thank you for letting
Right.
me go on this tangent. So I always like to preface the amount of times you've seen Bruce live is not a fair barometer of how big of a fan you are. And I imagine living in Hawaii makes it a little tougher during some tours. But for the record, do you count how many shows you've seen? If so, how many?
I don't normally, but I will say that I went through knowing I was going to speak to you, and I was like, how many times have I actually seen him? I've only seen him 14 times.
Okay.
Now, let me say that I was one of those knucklehead musician type guys from Jersey. When he broke up the E Street Band, I had a problem with that. And so that whole section of time when he was available to be seen, I refused stubbornly to go and see him. I bought the albums, right?
Yeah.
But I wasn't gonna go and see him. And I think I was in my 20s and early 30s, and I didn't like him not playing with T Street Band. I'm just being honest.
If you could expand on that a little bit, because that is academic to me. That is a historical moment, right? I did not become a passionate fan really till 2002, seeing him live the first time,
Yeah.
right? Like before that, I was a casual fan, certainly loved Tunnel, loved Born in the USA, bought the box set, but was not this fanatic the way I am now till really The Rising, seeing him live. So to me, it is almost, it's, I didn't live through the 60s riots. I was too young to understand that, but someone else would have that. So explain, share with me a little bit, because I always find that fascinating. And I call it the dark years, right? Bruce is, he's forgotten where he's came from, as we say down south, right? The worst thing someone could do is forget where they came from. And so I know people were feeling that way about him, weren't they?
They were the E Street Band. They were from Jersey. That was his thing. And then he left there and he went to California to get away from it. And he broke up his band and
Married an actress and then divorced and
then got divorced. And then I think he was, I don't know the man.
yeah.
And I know that he's very honest. So do I think that he was processing his life too? I think so. And does he have every right to do that? Absolutely. But when you're an idealistic kind of artistic musical kind of guy like me, like a band was a brotherhood to me. And the E Street Band was something that was sacred, just like the four members of U2 were sacred to me. I've had a hard time. I have been to the Sphere to see them play. I don't like that they're doing it without Larry Mullen Jr. The only reason I went was because I got to take my son finally to see them. And I don't know, as we all get older now, just as I've said with Bruce, I hope we see him more, all right? But there isn't a guarantee. And so you take the opportunities that you have, right? When he broke up the E Street Band, I was just, what are you doing? And then, I'd listen to the music he was doing, and it didn't have quite the edge that some of the other stuff had. And I missed the piano, and I missed Clarence's sax. And these are instrumentations that when I wrote music, I didn't put any of that into the type of stuff that I wrote. I was
Right.
influenced by Bruce as a storyteller, as a lyricist, but as just, the rock and roll kind of guy that he was too, right? And what that all stood for and what it meant to me. And so to take the band away, I just thought it was wrong. And when you're a young kid, you think everybody's going to live forever. You think you're going to live forever. I didn't think, okay, there's limited times to see Bruce Springsteen. And I'd already seen him. I'd seen him on the Born in the USA tour. I saw him on the Tunnel of Love tour. And I was already very committed to it. The Tunnel of Love tour, I actually took a train from Trenton down to Washington, D.C. to go see him play with my cousin at the Capitol Center. And then the next morning, got up and took a train back to college, right?
Yeah.
And that was when you have no money, but I wasn't going to miss my chance to see the Tunnel of Love Express tour. And then I moved out west, and then he broke the band up. And that was just, It was strange. And, you know, those albums like Human Touch, people sometimes they call those the not so great albums or whatever. I disagree. There's great songwriting in everything he does, right?
Sure.
Human Touch is a great song to me. Lucky Town. There's a lot of great tracks on those albums. He doesn't play them that often.
Better Days is one of my favorite songs by him, and I would love to hear that live. So real quick, I wanted to mention that I'm a big fan of the local sports station here called The Ticket. Mm-hmm. And both George and Craig, the morning host, huge U2 fans, just massive, right? And they were talking about, because the Super Bowl was in Vegas, U2's there, right? And they talked about, did they want to go without Larry playing the drums? Were they, their words, not my, betraying the band, right?
Yeah.
And they ended up saying that, one, they felt like it was, they've heard so much hype about the experience at the Sphere. And since they were going to be there for the Super Bowl anyway, they ended up going and having a great time. They enjoyed everything about it. But I do love the fact that loyalty of, I don't know if I can do this, because I had a little bit, both little Steven and Susie were out last year when he was in Dallas because of COVID. And then the next time they had other band members out, and Jake was out, but that wasn't, that was because of health. Yeah, I could imagine that is.
The interesting thing about to me, and the reason that I'm really grateful I did go, and I didn't really think about it as much because I'd seen Zoo TV. I sound like an old guy now, but I did. I saw all that stuff. And the thing that always excited me about U2 is that they were never about their past. They were always looking forwards, right? They were always about, they didn't do greatest hits tours and things like that. And so they did the Joshua Tree one. And that's when I shot Dream Out Loud. And at first when they announced that, I was like, what are they doing?
Yeah.
But it made sense to me because they had so many fans who weren't old enough to see them or even alive in 1987. They got a chance to see what that was like. Okay. Now then they do the same thing at the Sphere with the Octoon Baby album. And they're playing the whole thing. It's the only time they've ever played an album all the way through. I took Abel and Crystal to see them, and that was wonderful. Abel loved it. It is a spectacle. I would tell anybody, if you get a chance to see a show there, go. It's insane how cool it looks, but the sound in the Sphere is head and shoulders the best sound I've ever heard at a live show. The sound is incredible. So there's that. But as an old U2 fan now, and as an old Bruce Springsteen fan now, right? The one thing I appreciate about that now, and things that made me wish that I'd seen the River Tour when he did that, is that I got to hear U2 play Love is Blindness again. They will never play that again after this, right? Even if they go on the tour, and it's a deep cut on the B-side of Octoon Baby. It's just, they're not going to play that again. But that song is an amazing song. And I got to see them play it live again, right? And that's something that I am grateful for. Did I miss Larry? Absolutely. As a guy who played in bands and in music, it does not sound the same to me. I can hear a difference immediately. It's not to say that the kid Bram, who they have playing, isn't doing a fine job. He is, but it sounds different to me.
It's one of the beauties of the E Street Band in a lot of ways. We talk about how much it's stayed the same, but in a lot of ways it hasn't, right? Like once... Yeah. Born to Run happened. We've got that core group, but then little Steven left.
Yep.
Then Niels came in and Patty came in. And now then you get both of them. You get Niels and Steven. And then Morella toured with them for a while. Then we lost Clarence. We lost Danny. Yep. So it has been. And there's something about you too. It's the four of them.
Yep.
That's just stayed. And that's beautiful.
There's a thing about Bruce's sound, though, that's core. And I hear subtle differences, right? But I don't know. It doesn't affect me quite the same way. And it might be because it's Bruce and the E Street Band, right? Stevie certainly plays guitar very differently than Nils, right?
Yeah.
But Bruce, as a band leader, has done an incredible job with highlighting the different members of the band in different ways during shows, right? But you think of Because of the Night, that guitar part that he lets Nils play in the buildup, in the famous recording of that from the Winterland bootleg, you remember that one that was recorded on the radio? Everybody has it, right? I'm pretty sure, I don't know this for a fact, but I'm pretty sure that Bruce actually played that opening lead part. A lot of people don't realize that Bruce is actually a really good guitar player in that way.
Yes.
E Street Band hardcore fans know that. A casual fan might not realize that because he's got two other guitar players up there with him and they don't really think about that. Bruce is fantastic at that. There are things that he does with Stevie that are to Stevie's strengths. And there are things that he does with Nils that are to Nils' strength. Jake is different than his uncle. Okay. Nobody's ever going to replace Clarence, but it's beautiful. It's hard for me. The idea of seeing the E Street Band without Clarence is very difficult. A little harder than Danny. Danny was there from the very beginnings, pretty sure almost from the very beginning.
Yeah.
From Flemington, New Jersey, right?
Yeah.
But there is something about the friendship.
Yeah.
Clarence and Bruce. And again, it gets back to that rock bands in a sense since in their essence are like a street gang in a way. And the E Street Band most certainly was too. And so that friendship that he had with those guys, I know he loves hearing Jake play Clarence's parts. I imagine that sometimes it's tough for him. I don't know, but I know how close he was to Clarence. And they had a complicated relationship because Clarence was a complicated guy. But
you
don't go that long with somebody and not have a deep love for them. Way.
I thought it was interesting when the Wrecking Ball tour started that they had a horn section. Now, I realized they had done that in the past, the E Street horns, but it was almost like we know what big shoes they're going to fill, and we're not even going to try to start
that's
out with.
Right.
We're going to do that.
We're just going to do it. We're going to spread out the load with a horn section.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
And he's done that to fill Danny's shoes as well.
Yeah.
But again, it goes back to what I was saying about when he broke the band up. What one of my all-time favorites is Racing in the Streets. That piano part is Roy. I think Bruce wrote it. He did write it.
Yeah.
But the way Roy plays that live, that's what it needs to sound like.
It is. Yeah.
You get somebody else doing it, but it wouldn't be the same to me. It's just such a deeply beautiful moment in a Bruce Springsteen show when he decides to play that one. That piano is just haunting through and through. The band members matter is the point of what I'm saying.
I don't think I've told you this story, but I had someone on last year that I've quoted multiple times, and I wish I could remember who said it. And if you're listening, send me an email. But he said that in 99, he went to the reunion tour and he was standing in the pit in the middle of the show. And he said, "This is it. This is the ultimate moment.
Yep.
They've broken up. They've gotten back together. I've gotten to see the band. Maybe every once in a while they'll tour, but really, this is the height of my Springsteen fandom." And he says, "And I want to tell that guy, you have no idea what's coming. You don't know. You have The Rising. You have Magic. You have Bruce on Broadway. You have an autobiography. You have no idea. You're in halftime.
Exactly.
And I just thought that, and I imagine when you went to a reunion tour, did you feel like, yes, everything's right in the world again?
Yes, I did. I think, if I think about the different tours and things I've seen, it's amazing to say, yes, I saw him on the Born in the USA tour. That's incredible. But I think my all-time favorite Springsteen moments happened on the Magic tour, actually.
Yeah.
They had been back together a while. The reunion, the Rising, and now Magic. There was some grit and some gnarliness to the sound of that tour. The guitars were a little bit more up front on a lot of things. But they were really a tight band that throughout that tour. He still had Clarence. Danny passed away during that, I believe, or it was just before it. But I think the first I saw several on the Magic tour. And I think the first one I saw, I want to say Danny was there, but maybe that was the Rising tour. But yeah, it was I so yeah, that's much further down the line than the reunion tour in 99, but I think that's probably, from what I've seen, my all-time, like, that moment of zen for me in my Springsteen journey. I was old enough where I had a little bit of ability to travel to see him, so I traveled a few places to see him. They were older. I am a firm believer that rock and roll is the music of youth in a way. As musicians, we get better as we age. And so, as great of a band as they've always been, they've just gotten better. And in on the Magic Tour, they were, it sounds cliche, but they were on fire. They were incredible. And the set lists were amazing. It was that
Well,
was a magic time for me.
what I love that because there are times when, and I have a lot of patience and I have a lot, I try to give a lot of grace to people, but part of me gets a little tired with the almost holy veneration of the Darkness tour. That was when the band was the best. There'll never be better than the Darkness tour. That is the ultimate. And I'm sure it's a good show. I'm happy, but I think of a Magic tour or some of the shows that I went and saw, and I'm like, you're going to tell me that this isn't as good? You don't think that a band that has been playing together another 15, 20 years wouldn't be able to do? And so I think sometimes there is a little bit of almost nostalgia love in that.
I think that's true. You think about the bootlegs and the recordings that we have from then, right?
Yeah.
And that was before I was aware of it, but I was too young. I wasn't going to be able to see him then. But some of the versions of Prove It All Night are just, they are pretty amazing, right?
Oh,
And
absolutely.
he's done the long intro to Prove It All Night since then. Is it better now? I don't know.
Yeah.
There's also something about the thing about it too, Jesse, is that there's something about the newness. Like in 78, when he's first playing those songs, maybe some diehards heard some stuff that was debuted at
Yeah.
things before that, right? But that was the first time you were hearing those songs all the time, right? And we didn't have bootlegs of them. We didn't have recordings of them. We didn't have anything to look back at, right?
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of a magic to that. And it's still true, even with the stuff from Letters to You, right? Like, when he plays songs off of that album, they sound amazing, right? Because you haven't heard it yet before, right? It's a new experience with Bruce. And I think that's really important. The thing about the Magic Tour that, again, that was so awesome, it was an album that tour was heavy on tracks from that album,
Yes.
because it was a burner of an album. It was a great
Yeah.
album, but I think he was really enjoying that moment, right? He wasn't
Right.
looking back so much. He wasn't, like, he was about that moment in time and what he wanted to say and what he wanted to present. And those songs were prevalent in the set list. And so that was magical, right? Now, the reunion tour was magical because for a lot of us, we never thought you were ever going to see that again. So
Right.
it was a gift that was being given to you. The Rising tour, again, very heavy on the songs from The Rising. It was an emotional time for all of us, right? It was a
Yeah.
time of healing, and Bruce was helping us heal. But they were new songs, and so you find a different connection to that, right? So you think now, if you hear Prove It All Night now, you've heard it. If you've been on this journey for a while and you're lucky enough to see him play it a few times, maybe you've heard him play it live a few times, and so you have a Rolodex of times when you've heard it,
Right.
and so you have that natural nostalgia for that first time you heard something, right? Now, is it better now? Honestly, musically, probably,
Yeah.
because they're better players now, right? It's not as raw, that's for sure, because the band's bigger, right? You've got a horn section, you've got backup singers, you've got all these Susies up there.
Right.
On a night, sometimes you have Susie and Patty, right? Sometimes you have
Right.
Nils and Stevie, right? So it's a fuller band, and that gives you a fuller sound. I think about Max's playing, and he's just so precise and just crisp in his playing now,
Yeah.
right? He was a little bit more loose in the 70s. That precision now comes from years and years of doing it, right? It's just so rock solid now. the band had a little bit more of almost a funkiness to it in the 70s, right? You think of some of the East Street Shuffle songs, they were a lot of Motown in that, right?
And absolutely.
So it was a different band,
right?
I guess is what I'm saying. They're allowed to grow too. They influences and things they're listening to and things, ideas that they get, they're going to grow as well. I think the secret to that is like what you said, you got to accept the fact that they're going to grow as musicians and to treat it as a, try to treat it as a new opportunity to hear something with fresh ears.
Yeah.
They do a different arrangement on a song. Don't just immediately go, oh, that's not, why are they making that choice? What is it that they're trying to communicate?
Yeah, I know that we won't get into, because I've already kept you over an hour, the whole, a lot of people unhappy that he didn't break up the set list. There's a lot of, not a lot of diversity in the set list.
I want to say something about that real quick, if I can.
Oh, absolutely.
I think he's got a message that he's trying to convey.
I do too.
And I think he's trying to tell a story.
Yeah.
And so let him tell the story. I love following Stevie on Twitter because Stevie will actually engage with fans. And he tweeted a few times about it, about get over it. He's very Jersey in his response. But a couple of times he did take the time to say, a lot of thought went into this.
And I really, I really liked the set list. I was happy. But if I was going to be selfish, I was hoping for a Magic, a Rising, a Wrecking Ball, where we got five or six of the songs off Letter to You mixed into the set list, if you know what I'm saying, Dave.
I do. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're frozen. I can't hear
you. I know. I'm going to fix that for you right now.
Okay, hold on. That's okay.
There we go. There Sorry.
You. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I can hear you.
I had to switch cameras. I was using my phone because the picture is better. But anyway, I agree with you completely on that. And Bruce, now, I think we've been given so much Bruce goodness for so long.
Yeah.
That I think we've been spoiled.
I think so.
And I don't, there's just no other way to say that.
Yeah.
And I get it. Those songs and those moments and seeing the set list change, there's so much identity in our fandom that is wrapped up in that. Right. And so you almost feel betrayed. But instead, I would suggest to people to go, you know what? He's in his 70s now. I'm just grateful I get a chance to see him.
Yeah.
And maybe just enjoy it and look at it from, you know, all the memories you have of the songs he does choose to play. And when you leave, say a silent prayer that you hope you get to see him one more time. Because
Amen.
Because Amen. The guy's 74? 73? Did he just turn? Yeah. I'm bad with numbers like that. He's still doing almost 3-hour concerts.
Yes, he is.
And I think he went over 3 hours once on.
Yeah.
Who can do that?
Yeah. You're crazy. Absolutely.
Just enjoy it.
Exactly. I feel like we could keep going and we will. And we're going to have you back on a regular basis to keep everyone apprised of how the Kickstarter is going. But I think we're going to wrap it up this time. But I do got to ask you the Mary question.
Okay.
For those of you who came in late, I will be surprised, but every podcast episode is someone's first episode. Jay Armstrong, who is an honors English teacher, he's now retired, would give the lyrics to Thunder Road to his high school students. And they would read the poem as if it was a poem, talk about the themes and the imagery Bruce uses in the song. And then he would ask his students at the end of the class, does Mary get in the car? So, Dave, you've had 4 or 5 episodes to think about this because you've been a guest multiple times. But finally, it is your turn to answer the Mary question. Does Mary get in the car?
Yes, absolutely. Mary, climb in. It's a town full of losers. We're pulling out of here. We're pulling out of here to win. Yeah, that's, I think that's, gosh, I never even thought about it before. It was, of course she did. And to me, I've always sang it as Mary's just sways.
Yeah.
I've always been a sways guy. I think I've heard him do both, to be honest with you. But I've always said sways. And yes, I've just assumed always that she got in the car. Have you had many people that said that she didn't?
Half the people say no.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. Part of it is because some of them say, that he doesn't present a big enough case, a good enough case. Others because my wife is a theory. He called her ugly. You ain't a beauty. Hey, you're all right. Other people say that she's afraid, that she's, this is, you've got to take a leap of faith, and she's too afraid to do it. So yeah, it used to be about 60-40. 60 said yes, 40% they. Lately, it's been about 50-50. Half the people say no, she's too afraid, or she doesn't make the decision. The other half,
that's an interesting thing. That's a study in psychology, almost, I'd say, because it does it get down to the root of the person you asking? Are they an optimist? Are they a dreamer?
Yeah.
For me, I've chased dreams my whole life. You're going to get in that car. And that's probably why I've never even questioned it or wondered about it. I really never have. I've just always assumed that they rode off. And
yeah. A couple of interesting answers I've had. Someone, Terry Smith, who when you have some free time, I'm going to send you his way. He does a Music Talks podcast. The premise is you have to pick a song from every decade you've been alive, and that you use that to tell the story of your life.
Oh my gosh. And it has to be just one?
One song per decade.
Oh man.
So like, it's a wonderful podcast. He says no, but later when he's grown a little bit, they get together. Other people have said, yes, she gets the car, but when they stop at the next quick stop and he's going to get cigarettes, she goes, what am I doing? And leaves.
Yeah.
One of my favorite is if it's the band, she absolutely gets in the car because it's this triumphant ending. If it's Bruce solo, nope. He's so sad at the end.
Interesting.
Dave, this is so much fun. I can't wait. We're going to do this a lot more. I'm so thrilled. If someone wants to reach you, how can they?
You can reach me on my webpage, davidberryfilms.com, or the trampslikeusfilm.com. There's email links there, easiest. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter. I'm pretty easy to find these days.
Yes. I do want to stress that there is a link to fill out a form to set up for an interview. You should tell them what concerts you're going to be in person to. He is going to try to make arrangements if you're not going to be somewhere where he is,
right,
to try to get information. Dave has promised everyone he is going to get as many people's story in this film as possible. And yep. I think it's going to be amazing.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me be a fan tonight and for letting me to talk about thoughts on the music and stuff. I don't get to do that as often as I'd like to. And I enjoy it. And as you can tell, I could just keep going forever.
No, right? I do. There's another four or five questions. We didn't get to even get to go through every of them. So yeah, we'll do this again. Thank you, Dave. I am so happy that you reached out to me several months ago and said, hey, I've got an idea for a film. Do you want to hear about it? I feel I've really gained a great friend. And I'm so glad that I've been able to be a small part of this campaign and part of the film. And so thank you for that gift.
Thank you, Jesse.
Yeah. All right, listeners, go check out, be sure and follow the Facebook page, follow them on Twitter, AKA X, and send me any feedback you've got about this podcast. But for now, be safe, be kind, and we'll talk to you soon. Goodbye. I'm about to name some people who helped me keep this podcast going. They are the wonderful members of my Patreon group. I appreciate each of them. You can learn how to be a patron by going to patreon.com, look for Set Lusting Bruce, and for as little as $5 a month, you can support the podcast and get access to unedited episodes. And as little a dollar a month, you get a handwritten thank you note from me and a shout out at least once a month thanking you in an episode. So, Sean, David and Jennifer, Jeff, Sylvan, Liz, Yetta, Steve, Coach Randy, Rob, Bella, John, Betsy, Levi, Liz, Stephen, and Steve, Dale, Terry, Chris, and Mary. All of you are amazing, and thank you for being part of this wonderful group. You know I love you. There we go, another episode. I'm about to go through a couple of things where you can reach me and give me feedback. So if you want to skip this, I understand. But I do hope you check it out every once in a while. I'm available on Twitter at JesseJacksonDFW. The show is available at SetLustingBruce. You can send me an email, SetLustingBruce@gmail.com. You can send me a voicemail at 469-249-2442. I am currently doing a few other podcasts. Perfectly Good Podcast, John Hiatt from A to Z, where Sylvan Groth and I discuss every John Hiatt song in alphabetical order. My Babylon 5 podcast is Last Best Hope for Conversation, where Lou Karen and I discuss every episode of Babylon 5 in chronological order. I still am doing Next Stop Everywhere, the Doctor Who podcast with my brother in time, Charles Skaggs. And then finally, How Many Podcasts, the only podcast on the internet that counts, where my buddies and I discuss pop culture. You can go to our Patreon page and support the podcast for as little as a dollar a month. You can go to our Facebook page, like, and please, please go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast and leave a 5-star rating and review for all of the podcasts that I'm doing. It's okay if you don't listen to them, but if you subscribe and rate, it really will make my day better. Thank you, and I will talk to you soon.
You just heard the fun-talking, hard-rocking, music-loving, album-ranking, fan-thinking, joy-spreading, lyric-reading, story-sharing podcast that is the one, the only, Set Listing Bruce. The theme for Set Listing Bruce was written by David Rosen, used by permission.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.